So in the introduction of Nation Among Nations, you write that this book proposes to mark the end of American history as we have known it. What are your criticisms about this old history? And why has American history been shaped in such a way that it now should be abandoned?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that history as a discipline grew up with the making of the modern nation state, and it was an agent of the state. And one of its purposes, as it became academicized, was to create a common story that would be the foundation for national self-identity. That story seemed to me to become more obvious than it actually had been before in the 1990s, when there was all this talk about globalization and, in the U.S., multiculturalism. And it seemed to me that these two discussions suggested that the nation state was not this inherent natural carrier of history that we seem to assume it was, but actually something to be examined as to how it was constructed and how it changed over time. And it seemed like the suggestion was that a national history is some kind of sum or a result of the collision of histories larger than the state and smaller than the state. That is, globalization on the one side and our big debates about multiculturalism on the other side. And that was where I sort of moved from that position. That was a kind of purely intellectual thing about how one might construct a new kind of narrative. There was also the question of, in the United States, and this got worse a few years later as I began working on the book, beginning with the Bush administration, this revival of the idea of American exceptionalism, and that we do not share the history of the rest of the world, that for Americans, and particularly in the recent years, this notion that the international is everything but us. It's an intriguing usage that we're not in the international. In fact, when they created American studies programs in the early Cold War, they created area studies and American studies at the same time, but they didn't grasp that American studies was also an area in the international world.
Global history sometimes suggests that historians should leave aside the category of the nation and focus more specifically on global concepts and experiences. Your position seems to be different, as you hold the nation to remain a crucial political entity. How do you view the relationship between national and transnational factors?
Well, I think that the idea of abandoning the study of the nation for globalization misses the really absolutely fundamental point about the nation state. The nation state, I think, is the most powerful mobilizer of human beings in history, perhaps. And whatever its future may be, but I don't think it's going to go away very soon. It will have different permutations, perhaps, but it's not going away. But whatever its future is, it has shaped the world we live in, the world that is the product of the 19th and 20th century. The nation states and the system of nation states produce that. So I don't see how we can understand where we are without taking that in as a factor. Now, is the nation state as autonomous and self-contained as we thought? No. And is it also sometimes the product or deeply affected by global processes? Absolutely. One can see it as both floating on a sea of global processes, perhaps, but at the same time, those global processes are deeply shaped or profoundly shaped by the activity of interacting nation states as well. Says we haven't, as we've seen in recent years, when people can't cross borders very well anymore, and so this notion that we had a seamless world, it's not very seamless. That was a fantasy. It was seamless for some people in some circumstances, and so I think that we now have, I hope, a more complicated notion of the nation and a more complicated notion of the globe or global processes.
And what do you think of the efforts of historians such as Frederick Cooper and Jane Burbank we are trying to rewrite the history of the world with the category of the empire, and in some way suggesting that nations should be understood as empires more than strictly nations.
Well, I think two things. One, I think that their recovery of empire is extremely important. Part of my experience in writing this book was to learn a great deal about empires. And I think that there may be three categories in the world. That is empires, there are nation states, and what I would call, and what I think something like the United States in the 20th century is, and most of 20th century nations have at least aspired to this, certainly the Soviet Union was too, is a nation slash empire, with some of the characteristics of a nation state, but some of the ambitions of empire. And I think that empire, at least to an Americanist, is quite striking, because empires did not demand the kind of homogeneity that nations do, because of the nature of citizenship, which is a fundamental part of the nation state. They are less interested in borders. It's the dynasty, excuse me, it's the dynasty that has to survive. And if they lose a province, it's not fatal. To a nation state, this is catastrophic. They don't even have to have all their provinces contiguous. You can have, you know, colonies, all kinds of places. Savoy doesn't have to be, it can be a part of Austria and things like this. So I think that thinking about that solves a lot of the multicultural problems that we have in the nation state, because you don't demand uniformity. In fact, there are different rules for different subunits of the empire. The nation state looks for a certain kind of homogeneity, is at least formally equal citizen, although we know that socially they're not. And so that sets a whole set of alternative problems. It seems to me that I've been much taken by a book recently written by, he's a historian named Harold James, called The Roman Predicament. And to crudely summarize the argument, it is that republics often end up becoming empires while trying to save the republic, because the only way you can save the republic is by becoming an empire. And actually, a German historian, Michael Geyer, and I just finished collaborating on an essay on Germany and the United States in the 20th century as nation empires competing with each other. And I think this third category helps as we think about it.
In all of your five chapters, you aim at showing how deep the connections between American history and other histories have always been. You concentrate on major events of American history, such as the discovery of the continent and the War of Independence. One of the most illuminating examples of your approach seems to be the chapter on the Civil War. How does this apparently internal war between Northern and Southern states connect to global history?
Well, it is indeed such a very central American event. It seems implausible that it is part of something larger, but it actually is a part of what we've just been talking about. It is a part of the construction of modern nation states. And this is what the Republican Party understood. They were seeking a stronger, more centralized state than the Jacksonian period had. And so we see at roughly this time, there are a number of these kinds of consolidations. They take different forms. There's Germany, there's Italy, there's Japan. These are the most classic ones, but there are lots of other ones that are less obvious than that. Argentina is centralizing at the same time. And there are, the world is starting to get divided up between those in nation states and those in something else. But the other thing that really struck me, and I should add, there are two other, well, one other thing I want to emphasize now, then I'll say a second thing, is that throughout that period, say from 1840 to 1880, there's a tremendous amount of violence. That the Civil War, our Civil War, is not the only one. By one count, there were 177 wars during that four-year period. And many of these are connected to the consolidation of modern nation states. The other thing I would say, and the thing that really enabled me to understand this the way I ended up understanding it, is Abraham Lincoln's fascination with the revolutions of 1848 in Europe. And it seemed to me that those are exactly the ideology of the Republican Party. They were about freedom and nation, and that the idea that the nation is the vehicle to achieve that freedom. And so it's not only in the United States that you have the emancipation of 4 million slaves, you also have the emancipation in the same period of 40 million serfs. And I think that, so there is both in the notion of consolidation, but also a complete restructuring of the understanding of capital and labor that is a part of in the US, free labor was the big slogan of the Republican Party. But in a certain sense, that was the slogan everywhere, along with constitutionalism, parliamentary government, and the like.
So would you say that there was an international anti-slavery movement in the 19th century having influence in American history?
Absolutely. One of the things that happens after the American Revolution is Britain, which had always thought itself the paragon of liberty, is getting challenged. It gets challenged by the American Revolution, who claimed that British were was a tyranny ruled by the British, and the French Revolution, which makes great claims of freedoms, liberties. And this, it's been recently argued, made Great Britain decide they were going to regain the high moral ground by leading the anti-slavery thing globally, which they did. And there is a very honorable period of British history. So that changes the context of the United States. I think the ideology of the revolutions of 1848, I wouldn't say they were necessarily anti-slavery in Europe because it was serfdom, but anti-unfree labor in that sense. And it's also liberalism of, John Stuart Mill, Adam Smith kind of liberalism is operating here, very much operating in the United States as well. So that is a shift, and I would attribute it to essentially the liberal ideologies. And I mean, Lincoln again and again talks about slavery is a black mark on our position among the liberal thinkers of the world. They think we're ruining the greatest experiment of all time. And that was a very conscious awareness. And at a certain point, we're among the last in the Americas. Only non-republics still had slavery. Brazil was still an empire, and then you had the Spanish colonies in the Caribbean. Everyone else had abolished it. So there was a global pressure on the United States.
You are also challenging another common statement about American history, which was summed up a century ago by Werner Zumbart in a famous question: why is there no socialism in the USA? What is your answer to this seemingly American exception?
Well, this one has been haunting us ever since 1904. I think actually he was simply wrong, but I will say why. But it fits into this American exceptionalist argument, that the exceptionalist argument assumes that there's a norm from which we deviate. What that effectively does is suggest that there's the United States, which is A, and all the rest of the world is B, or I suppose some critics would reverse the letter, but either way. One of the things that I really, well, first I have one immediate response. Tell me where socialism was everywhere else in 1904. It's hard to find. In 1912, we have a socialist candidate for the presidency who wins 6% of the vote against what were probably fairly called three other, at the time of the Civil War, he had four candidates too. Four candidates, all of them by some definition are not liberal or progressive, that is Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Taft. So you have Eugene Debs on the Socialist Party ticket. So I think that was as good a show for 1912 as any place else. But without arguing that one, because that could be whatever, was that the American Socialist Party the same? the question is a norm. Where's the norm? There's a presumed norm that actually didn't exist. The norm, it turns out, is a social democratic party, as in Germany, I suppose. But in fact, the global norm, there isn't one. There's a whole, at least what I discovered, there's a whole spectrum of different and sometimes complicated positions. So it's a bad question for which we've given a lot of bad answers.
So now, shifting to questions of historical methods, how do you situate your approach among other historical currents such as comparative history, connective history, or global studies?
Well, I think that in a certain sense, I end up trying to weave them all together. At the beginning of all of my thinking on this, I wanted to distinguish myself from comparative history because comparative history isn't real-time history necessarily. You can study comparative slavery in the Greeks and the antebellum South. They're not sharing the same history. So I was against it. But in fact, once I started doing a connected history, it was irresistible to not comment that it went this way in one place and differently in another. So I think the kinds of connective or transnational histories are almost inevitably implicitly comparative, and that's not a bad thing. As far as the global studies, I guess I've come up with a notion that there are global processes out there. There have been global processes around for a long time. They're much denser now than they were a century or two ago, but they're there. There's communication and more communication in the earlier period than I ever would have imagined, so that people know what other people are thinking about similar issues. But where national history, as I'm trying to do it, connects with global history is that although there may be a common understanding of a problem, some common potential solutions, the actual political resolutions in a given state will have to do with the political traditions, the array of interests, which will all be slightly unique. And you know, I was really quite struck in our progressive era of reform, the opponents were businessmen, the principal opponents. And in Japan, businessmen were the principal opponents. But in Russia and Argentina, it was the landed elite who were opposed, and took through most of Latin America, it was the landed elite, still is. And so you have a lot of the same issues, but the way they work through the local political system often produce not radically different results, but different results, and they affect the pace of reform as well.
It seems obvious that your book has a political and civic intent. Were the Bush presidency and its contempt for other nations' opinions in leading the war on terror important motivations for your work?
Well, they weren't motivations at the beginning. As I said, I started thinking about this in the 1990s. But the book, I was writing it during the Bush presidency, and indeed it was constantly on my mind that one of the things I really wanted to do was to fight against this notion of us and the rest of the world, and whether we care about them or not is an option. that it was very much there. And I mean, in some of the reviews of the book in more general publications, not academic publications, I think particularly of The Economist, which by that point was getting upset with Bush after originally supporting him, you know, they made the point that this is a timely kind of thing that the Americans have to, as the reviewer put it, keep relearning this lesson. And one of the things that I realized, that this is a relearning, that American history wasn't always as exceptionalist as it was during my lifetime. That the frame that we've been operating is heavily the result of the Cold War. That until 1940, there were most of the what we would call the great American historians although when they thought of the world, they only thought of the North Atlantic, but they certainly understood American history to be entangled with other histories going all the way back to Francis Parkman and in the 19th century and Henry Adams. And so we have been in a kind of bubble in the Cold War era, and it's probably not an accident that we're getting got a little bit out of it before we got back into it in the 90s. But it was there, and I did want it to have some impact on that thinking.
In your book, you insist on the fact that the USA has been a self-denying empire since the end of the 19th century. You also write that Americans have always found it difficult to imagine themselves as an enemy, as a problem for other people. Could we say that the Americans' refusal of seeing themselves as having imperial powers explain George Bush's foreign policy during the last 8 years?
Well, I think that the really interesting thing of the for me for the Bush period and the neoconservative sort of visibility during this period was the acceptance of empire. That historically Americans have always denied it, but suddenly, with the Bush presidency, there are the left always said there was an American empire, and you know they were always criticized for that. And in fact, when I was beginning this book and I talked to people, there was going to be a chapter on empire. How could there be a chapter on empire? Well, because there was just the Philippines, that little moment. So what about coming across the continent? Oh, that was westward expansion, not empire. And there are all kinds of ways of avoiding it. But there is this revival. Now it's in bad odor, but for 5 or 6 years, neoconservatives were defending, and Neil Ferguson was asking Americans to be like the great British Empire. It was the first time in American historiography and American public discussion that the right and the mainstream were using the word empire in a affirmative sense. That didn't change, though, this problem that goes all the way back to the beginning and hasn't changed, and that is this our inability to see how we appear to other people. We look at our motives. We don't look at our consequences. And so Americans say, even if they're doing terrible things, it's our goodness that brought us to Iraq. Why don't they understand that? It's our goodness that brought us to Vietnam. We just wanted to save them from communism. What everyone thinks of that statement, the really amazing thing is that they can't see that sometimes even what is genuinely a generous act can sometimes look from the other side like one more exertion of American power over people. And I think that's just a vast amount of international education has to start to occur to this, in this society. Otherwise, we're going to keep doing what we do because we just don't look at consequences. We only look at our goodwill or our rightness in doing what we're doing as if rightness were some absolute that one actor can know what it is, the other affected people have no insight into it.
One wonder if historians as a community can have enough intellectual power to rival with the political uses of history. In France, for instance, the creation in 2007 of a ministry in charge of designing the national identity was viewed as a major step back by historians and citizens trying to explain how the nation has been shaped by international migrations of values. The relationship between academic life and public debate has been a constant concern of your research. How can historians succeed in promoting more open narratives of the nation? How can they manage to overcome the nationalist biases of contemporary politics?
Well, it's a big challenge. I think that historians have to get much more involved. That is academic historians, university historians have to get much more involved with the way our children are taught in schools, particularly in the high school level. For whatever it's worth, that's what I'm doing now. I'm now trying to write a college U.S. history survey textbook, putting American history into a global perspective the way this other book did a few episodes. And, that's where the teachers are taught. I also think that George W. Bush has helped on this particular thing. American intellectuals never have had a tremendous impact. I mean, one of the issues of the presidential campaign is that one of the candidates is too highly educated and too smart, according to some people. I think that one of the things Bush has done is has shown the limits of ignorance. I think that academics have enclosed themselves too much into their own little world, it is costing us. It is costing us seriously. And it's not that if we raised our hand and said we were happy to come join in the public discussion, everyone would invite us in. But I think that one of the things that I think academics, maybe because they have an image of the French intellectual of great power and influence in society, they think you have to start at the top and that's the only place to influence. But actually, we're scattered all through the country. And in fact, education in this country is locally controlled. There's no national curriculum. And one doesn't have to publish an article in the New York Times telling people what to do about this matter. But that's actually a point that Richard Rorty made about academics some years ago in the previous financial crisis in the 80s. You know, just write for your local newspaper. Those are voters, those are citizens. You know, sometimes we reach too high and get nowhere. But if a lot of people were operating on a lot of fronts, we could do a lot. The other thing is, again, just sticking with history, the high school textbook business is something that has been outsourced to multinational corporations who are interested in selling textbooks. And the political right has organized hit squads that read these things and then testify before state legislatures and state education adoption committees with all kinds of outrageous complaints about things, whether it's evolution and history are the two big hits that they go after. There very rarely are any historians at these things. And yet we may have to start showing up.
Thank you very much.